Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the On the Spot series by China Forum. In this series, we return to the platform of international forums and webinars where leading minds in academia, government, business, technology, and media deliver novel, collaborative responses to the global issues of the day.
Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast, On the Spot series. This is Beibei with China Forum. As dangers loom large for the world today, a possible second Cold War has become a frequent topic among politicians and scholars across the globe. Is a second Cold War inevitable? Is win-win cooperation merely a pretty-sounding strategy or a deep-rooted and realistic philosophy? Is transcending bloc politics possible in the post-Western era? With these questions in mind, I had an in-depth discussion with Professor Richard Sakwa on the sidelines of the 6th Forum on Security and Strategy in Beijing in late March. Professor Sakwa is the author of the newly published The Lost Peace, How the West Failed to Prevent a Second Cold War, and also a professor of Russian and European politics at the University of Kent at Canterbury, UK. In the discussion, Professor Sakwa offers us penetrating insights into a period of history that we thought we have thought over, revealing deeper logic that has the power to change the course of history today. Hope you will enjoy the conversation as I did. Hello, Professor Sakwa. I've been looking forward to our interview. Thank you for your time. So we see the world going through a difficult period, transitioning from unipolarity to the onset of multipolarity. I think it's time that we really think about what we can or should do. But let's start with some definitions to pave the way. So you have a new book that came out in November last year titled The Lost Peace, How the West Failed to Prevent a Second Cold War. Now, the title implies that we already are in a second Cold War. Can you briefly explain that? And also how it differs from the Cold War that we are familiar with.
Thank you. I'll start with the second question. What is a Cold War? A Cold War is a particular type of international politics. It isn't just normal great power politics. It isn't just the normal course. A Cold War has certain specific features. For example, it includes the demonization of the enemy. It means the weakness of diplomacy. It means a condition of enduring hostility. And it's also one in which the issue is not the policies of the opponent, it's their very existence, the character of it. So in the Soviet-US Cold War, it was communism versus capitalism. This takes us to the second Cold War. In my view, as you know, the first Cold War ended in 1989. We then had 25 years of Boris Yeltsin called the Cold Peace. And the 25 years of the Cold Peace, 1989 to 2014, none of the fundamental questions of European security were resolved. We had NATO enlargement, but NATO enlargement is only a marginal issue because if it had enlarged within a larger security framework of pan-European with Washington, Moscow, then it wouldn't have mattered. But the point is the failure to bring Russia in to an inclusive security relationship. So that was the Cold Peace, and that exploded in 2014 in Ukraine, and it's got worse ever since. And of course, now we have a hot war. At the same time, US and China have slid into a Cold War as well. So this began effectively with Hillary Clinton, the pivot to the East, and it was a declaration that China will no longer be accepted on its own terms as a security and even economic partner. It basically said, we will indulge in exactly what we did with the Soviet Union earlier and then Russia, a policy of neo-containment, pushing back against China's rise. So that's why this Cold War is very different from the first one. It's different actors. China is obviously far more important. We have Russia, a different type, no longer communism. The ideological framework is different. They call it autocracy versus democracy. But it's ultimately all about containing the political, well, the West, containing Russia and China and preventing them acting as fully fledged partners in the management and engagement in international affairs.
So it sounds like the US does not want an equal partner.
It does not.
It does not.
No. It wants a partner who then they use funny words like responsible stakeholder. But as we shall see, China has always been a responsible stakeholder in terms of the international system established in 1945. Mm-hmm. It's a founder member of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. So what are they talking about? Mm-hmm. When by responsible stakeholder, it means a China that was willing to subordinate its interests to those of the United States.
To the UN, yes, but to the United States, that's a different matter.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is how the end of the Cold War, when Gorbachev put an end to the Cold War, it was never a capitulation to US-led West. Mm. It was always, let us all subordinate ourselves to the UN, the UN international order, international law, and all of the spirit of 1945 in which the United Nations was established.
Well, isn't it sad how things turned out then?
It's about the saddest thing in the universe. It was so unnecessary. It was so avoidable, just like the war in Ukraine. It was an unnecessary war. Mm. It was an avoidable war, perhaps the most avoidable war in history. Maybe we'll go on to that. But basically, all that had to happen was five words in Kiev. Ukraine will not join NATO. Mm. But, of course, that's only symbolic. It meant Ukraine would not become militarized. It wouldn't become a platform, a border post, you know, a bulwark against Russia and so on. So NATO, obviously, wasn't going to join NATO for many decades. Mm. But we're talking about it symbolically, what it means.
Right. And another term that we want to cover before we move on is a brief definition of the political West.
Yes, thank you. For me, this is a fundamental category. People talk about the West, but it's nothing. Russia likes to talk about the collective West. Mm. And that's just all very vague in historical West. This political West is a very specific beast. It was a beast created by the First Cold War. It is a military-industrial complex. You remember that communist, Dwight D. Eisenhower, in his farewell address in January 1961? He condemned the emergence of a military-industrial complex. The political West is generated and continues and perpetuates the logic of Cold War, as we defined it earlier. Always is perpetual hostility, perpetual attempt to contain the adversary, the lack of respect for the legitimacy of the alternative model of modernity, model of development, model of modernization. Mm. So the political West after 1989, without the Soviet Union as a balancer, China was still relatively early stages of its re-emergence, Because, of course, as we know, in the 18th century, it was the world's largest economy, etc. Mm. So the political West, after 1989, without a serious opposition, it metastasized.
What does that mean?
It means it radicalized. It became universalized. It says, we are the only way. The Western way, our way, or no way, or the highway. Mm. So it, and then, of course, the idea of unipolarity, the idea of...
The end of history.
Well, of course, that was the ideology. I mean, if you want a long thing, I could give you... It radicalized in five different ways. Just very briefly, you started. It radicalized, I know you don't have that much time, but radicalized, just it's important, I think. End of history is embedded in... So it radicalized in a Hegelian manner. Mm. That's end of history. Radicalized in a Kantian manner, the obsession with human rights. Obviously, used instrumentally. They don't care about human rights one way or the other. Friends can do anything they like. Enemies are condemned for human rights.
As we're witnessing in Gaza.
Absolutely. Mm. And Hobbesian way, in a war, the militarism, you know, war of all against all. The Hayekian way, neoliberalism, and indeed, I would probably go on, Marcusean in terms of ideology and identity politics. Mm. So that's the political West. So this political West is a phenomenon which perpetuated itself. Can I just say it's got two aspects to it?
Sure.
It's got the empire aspect, militarism, NATO, all of that. But also it has a positive aspect, what I call the Commonwealth aspect, the delivery of public goods, the sponsorship for globalization, some fantastic good for China. But so there's constant tension between the empire aspect and the Commonwealth aspect. Mm. What we say to Americans, and why any talk I have is never anti-American, I say there is a better America out there, the Commonwealth America. Right. You guys go and work on that. Mm. You solve your domestic problems. Your 54,000 people died last year from gunshots. Mm. Thousands of children. You deal with your problems before you sort out Chinese problems.
Very nice summary. And in one of your interviews about your new book, you mentioned this intellectual exhaustion of the political West and said there is no positive vision of how to transcend the logic of conflict and how to move into a world which could allow genuine human development to take place. Can you explain this intellectual exhaustion of the political West?
It's absolute intellectual bankruptcy. In fact, I would go further. We have a political and intellectual degradation in the West. It has many facets. One of them is the closure of public sphere debate. Today in the West, we have a neo-McCarthy atmosphere, McCarthy of the 1950s, communist witch hunt. Today, the closing down of debates whenever we try to raise questions to say, look, hang on, whatever war situation, you know, we should listen and understand. Doesn't mean endorsing, but listen and understand the Beijing perspective, the Moscow perspective, the New Delhi perspective, and so on. Mm. And again, it means engaging in what I call political dialogism as a mode of politics.
Right.
That means that through dialogue, both sides change.
Mm. I love the analogy you made about the book, The Brothers Karamazov.
Oh, yes, yes.
How after 500 pages of talk and talk and more talk,
And even more talk.
But at the end, all the characters change.
Absolutely.
But you do need to be patient. And for the magic of communication to play out, to flourish.
Diplomacy is all about patience. Diplomacy is about long-term relationships. Mm. Diplomacy is about ultimately building trust. Mm. And unfortunately, this degradation is completely engaged in what I call anti-diplomacy. It destroys not only these sort of soft aspects of diplomacy of negotiation, but also the physical infrastructure, expelling diplomats, closing down compounds like Obama did for Russia in December 2016, and all of this. It also means, you know, there's endless imposition of sanctions. Addicted to sanctions. It's like a drug addict. It just needs to pile more and more and more on. And of course, you know, Russia today, China tomorrow. So it's already started in 2019 with Trump.
Yes. How many more can they have?
They're just beginning. Oh, you guys watch out.
And also, I'm both appalled and mystified by this. You are either at the table or on the menu mode of thinking. Yes. I mean, in my view, life comes in circular motion, with every party being in interdependent relationships. And we've all, let's say, shared a piece of cake with our siblings or cousins or our neighbor and survived and maybe even enjoyed the experience. Why is it so impossible for some people to understand? We're not in camps.
Yeah. Do you know, that's a question, of course, you should put to them, not to me, because I find it equally unviable, incredible at this sort of behavior. So when China has its global security initiative and all those other initiatives, and they talk about win-win situation, community of common destiny, and all of this language, it's very serious. China is appealing to the better nature of the political West.
Thank you for
acknowledging that. It's to establish a common symbolic space and a common ideological space. And so it's saying to the West, look, you guys behave as well. We share these visions. We can share and work together for peace and development. Whereas now they're seized by this logic, this Cold War logic of war, militarism, containment, arms race, etc.
Actually, about win-win cooperation, China has been emphasizing tirelessly the possibility of win-win cooperation between nations and has been demonstrating its possibility with the Belt and Road Initiative and also with BRICS and other institutions. Exactly. So I was so happy that someone recognized that these are not empty slogans, but in your words,
it's a profound philosophy of international politics.
Because, you know, my personal belief that China believes in the possibility of win-win situation, not because it sounds pretty, but because throughout its long history, we found that that's the only way that things will work. You know, for any long-term relationships to maintain and to grow, both sides have to be relatively satisfied. There has to be compromise. It's not a tactic. It's a deep philosophical belief. But then, as you said, many people hear this, they kind of brush it away because, oh, they're just saying it.
Yeah, but on the other side, you must understand that clearly, if the US and its US-led political West has enjoyed such dominance for so long, and absolute dominance after the end of the Cold War, the emergence of China began to raise alarm. So in a sense, it was going to mean an adjustment of the United States to a relative decline and also, you know, a peer competitor. I mean, it's worse than what you say, because it wasn't just they not accepting it. Those people like John Mearsheimer and others, Allison, talking about Thucydides.
Yeah. Exactly.
In my view, it's not inevitable. There's agency. Leaders have to take choices. And part of the degradation of the political West is the very low quality of leadership.
If you were a professor in the United States, will you actually dare to say all these in public?
Excellent question. I'm a professor in England, and do I dare to say it? I've already been accused of being in the pay of Moscow. I'm now accused, literally, I got an email the other day that I'm in the pay of Beijing. And if I'm in the pay of Beijing, don't forget to put the check in the post. I haven't got the money yet.
Yes. I want to turn the attention to the rest of the world, because I think the political West seems so stuck in its ways that we might wait for a long time for things to start changing on their end. What can the rest of the world do to transcend it? Because I think this time around, if we are in a second Cold War, I feel the rest of the world is a lot more awake and also stronger than the Cold War that we are familiar with.
Absolutely. There's two elements to that. The first one is that international system, well, a Yalta-Potsdam system of 1945, but I call it Charter Internationalism, has matured. The international system, state system, has matured. 193 members of the United Nations. None of them will accept to be simply a walk-on player, a little apart from Europeans, to the United States. But, I mean, thinking of Indonesia, I'm thinking of Mexico, I'm thinking of, so many, Brazil, South Africa, right, over Gaza, taking the initiative, putting the political West to shame. Mm. So on the International Court of Justice issue. So this has matured. And now we have, and I regard that as entirely positive. So, you talked about multipolarity, which is whatever a poll is. But certainly now we have 200 odd states, not all of them in the United Nations, engaging in international politics. And hence these middle powers now exert. The second thing is they sometimes organize within the non-aligned movement. But you say, what can they do? What we now see is the emergence of a political East. And this political East isn't simply the opposite of the political West, in which case it just reproducing the logic of conflict, bloc politics, all the bad things. The political East is something which is not right. Anti-West. It is counter, which is a different logic. It is opposing the logic which generates this alliance system, bloc politics, extension of NATO to the Pacific, all that brilliant success which led on to war. Indeed, led on to war here. So they want to introduce that into the Asia-Pacific region, calling the Indo-Pacific with Australia. So the political East, Shanghai, you mentioned the organizations, but it's also, it's above all, not even the organizations. It's the spirit, for example, which always animated ASEAN, the Asian peace project, peace and development project. China's part of it. ASEAN countries are part of it. India's part of it. And this spirit isn't Asian. I mean, it is Asian, it's local manifestation. But it is precisely that charter spirit of 1945, charter internationalism, sovereign states, but not protectionists, not fighting for their bit of pie at your expense, but a type of genuine internationalism based on multilateralism, which understands the concerns and needs of other states.
And I think that's just human. In my understanding, that's basic human instincts. But maybe...
Well, that's not the basic instinct for of some American people. Or British imperialists. So this word imperialism is used very loosely. And I hesitated to use it, but I now use it because it's now inspired by that spirit of a totally different one. For example, the decision to put pressure on China, the decision to turn from what was a very healthy partnership, had its problems of imbalance and trade imbalance and so on. This decision to start imposing constraints on China was taken by a very small group of people. And why wasn't it more openly discussed? There's also a decision-making process in Washington. And you have some virulent Sinophobes who are able to dominate the agenda. For whom you're thinking, realists would just laugh at it and say, that is not how international politics works. And I and you would then answer, look, guys, it's the only way that international politics can work in the nuclear age, where we have so many problems like climate change and so on facing us. So you guys are not the realists. We are idealists. We are ethical realists. We balance our realism. China is clearly its own national interest pursuit, quite rightly so, as long as it takes into account the concerns of others. But at the same time, it has to be within this ethical framework of charter internationalism.
To be honest, I think I'm losing hope a little bit on hoping that they can understand it. But the rest of us certainly can, while we still have the chance, to make a difference. And as you mentioned in one of your interviews, there's nothing waiting in the wings to replace the UN system, however flawed. And China has always believed that there is one system in the world which is the international system with the UN at its core, but at a level below it, which you call at the second level.
International politics.
International politics, we have been witnessing a what you called a reorganization and a shakeup. And this leads to what you mentioned, the post-Western political alignment, not the anti-Western we emphasize, but post-Western, which transcends bloc politics and the competitive dynamic and the attempt to defend hegemony. And the key word here is transcend. Can you elaborate a little bit? I love that word.
Yes.
Transcendence. Maybe that will save us.
Yes. So this agenda of transcendence was put on the agenda in the modern or recent years by Gorbachev, Mikhail Sergeyevich, at the time of Perestroika, when he said on a European level, look, we need to transcend the logic of Cold War. And he did. They put an end to the Cold War. Washington, of course, interpreted that as the defeat of the Soviet Union. And instead of transcendence, they then engaged in a policy of enlargement of the political West, first of all within the European context, NATO and so on, and then globally. So this political West argues it's the only model of modernity. But you're absolutely right. What are the sources of hope, sources of regeneration, renewal, of optimism, as you put it, in the world today, which would allow us to transcend the logic of conflict, the arms race, especially the nuclear age, diverting of resources into military, all this wasteful nonsense.
Mm.
Well, that's a fantastic question. My answer is going to be very weak because I mentioned the political East is emerging.
Mm-hmm.
There's elements of it. It also means maintaining, for example, existing commitments. For example, the Russo-Chinese alignment, not an alliance, alignment is fundamentally important for all countries, for Russia and China in particular, but I think it's one of the core axes because you've got a 6,000-kilometer border with Russia.
Exactly.
You need a safe, normal thing.
Yeah, anytime.
Whatever
regime,
yes.
Yeah.
And don't forget that the political West is doing absolutely everything to drive China and Russia apart. And of course, in many ways, it's so...
Well, the result is not what they want.
Well, we've heard some of the speakers today effectively endorsing that view. That Russia is a failed power. It's going to lose this war. China's got to distance itself from it. I think that's suicidal. Obviously, China's got to be very careful. I'm talking continue this very wise and balanced policy.
Right.
And of course, then China has to work very hard to establish good relations with India. So at that level of international relations, and of course, all its neighbors, Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines, very difficult, of course, because the United States are constantly sending these countries out, you know, to undermine balance in the regional peace.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, they've now, when CENTCOM or the United States established its command in Africa, then their whole stack of wars began. You know, wherever the US goes, it sort of follows war, follows in its train.
Well, to the benefit of the military.
Absolutely. It's golden age for them.
Yeah.
But it's a nightmare, dark age for humanity.
Exactly.
And how do we fight it? We fight it by doing what we're doing.
Right.
As a little step.
You've been putting forward the dialogical approach. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or political dialogism. My understanding is that politics through talk.
Yeah.
That's just...
Well, negotiations, diplomacy.
Negotiations and understanding.
Engagement.
It will play its magic if given enough time
commitment
and space.
And commitment.
And commitment, exactly.
Yes. And it can take many levels. You can have it, back-channel negotiations, keeping everything open. But at the moment, for example, between Washington and Moscow for many years now, complete blockage. Nothing. Even worse than it was in the Soviet years.
You know, this time when we have actually hot wars playing out, and maybe people believe that, you know, we have no time to talk. You know, we're too busy. But I personally would believe that this is precisely the time that we need to talk. But if the party who are so engaged in the zone of conflict and they just don't have the time to listen, can the rest of us do something more?
Yeah.
Talk more or build more institutions?
We know the 12-point peace plan, which China put forward for the Russo-Ukrainian war.
Mm.
It was a good statement of principles, obviously.
Well, we can start from there.
Yeah. Absolutely, you have to start. It's the foundations.
Right.
But then people say about China, there's no follow-up. You know, what's your concrete, specific proposals? I'm not sure that's your responsibility to do that. You want to establish a framework in which things could move forwards. But as you say, there's at the state level, but there's also, you know, politics. We talked about the international system.
Right.
We talked about international politics. Then there's still, of course, this third level, which is international political economy, economic engagement, and so on, which, of course, now we see the fragmentation of globalization there, but it still continues. And at the fourth level, we have transnational, international civil society.
Mm.
And, you know, I've been a great believer in citizen diplomacy, you know, student exchanges. I understand that there's only 300 American students in China this year.
Well, yes, but I think there will be more. We're also betting on the sense and sensibility of the common people.
Yes.
The politicians have their agendas. And moving on to more optimistic developments, for example, BRICS and ASEAN, as you mentioned, you know, bringing together nations from BRICS, bring nations from different continents with different political systems, and to center around the concept of mutual development and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So can you tell us the significance of these newer institutions under the umbrella of the UN system? And there's even talk about the international financial system, but I think that's further on. How important are these, and do they have a bright future, in your opinion?
In the fundamental sense, these are dialogical institutions because they're a framework and a platform for discussion. For example, within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS, it provides a platform for the President of China to meet with the Indian leader and those other leaders. And it's been very effective. In terms of practice, of course, the BRICS New Development Bank is actually a very successful organization. And the AIIB, Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank, which has been working up to sort of international standards for to make all the projects viable and so on. As for BRICS Plus, it's extraordinary, as you say, the new members, Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, and of course, Saudi Arabia was going to be a member. I actually believe that the more platforms you have like this, which, as I said, not anti-West, but post-West, it's a game changer. But at the moment, all their foundational documents, all their documents appeal to the UN values, just like Chinese documents do. And as I keep saying to people, it's important because what they're trying to do is to establish this common symbolic space, common political space. And indeed, by doing that, they then appeal to the political West to say, you have your better nature as well, your Commonwealth aspect. Make that more powerful. Push back your military-industrial complex. Push back your complex of primacy, of dominance, of hegemony, and so on. And we can then live in... Because these wars, first of all, it'd be catastrophic, the end of humanity. But it is so pointless. Who needs it? I've been engaging a lot with American peace movements. And there's some magnificent people out there. The Massachusetts Peace Association, Peace Praxis International in California, and so on. And there's so many great people.
Speaking of peace, in your book and your interview, you mentioned positive peace versus negative peace. Can you briefly explain?
Negative peace is simply the absence of war. It's what we had for the Cold Peace between 1989 and 2014. It was a negative peace, simply the absence of war. A positive peace, you have to work at it. You have to start to build those elements of trust.
What China has been doing.
And like China has been doing. In fact, the U.S.-China relationship for a long time and the potential to develop, you know, this old concept of interdependence, that through economics engagement, you begin to build a framework. Unfortunately, interdependence theory doesn't work because you have to have the political will and the leadership to make it work. And of course, in the West, they don't do it. And the positive piece is what the spirit of 1945 was about. The world had just had the most catastrophic war in its history. Millions died, genocide, and so much, and damage to Europe and the world. That's the vision of a positive peace embedded in the United Nations.
More positive topic. So you talked about potential, and you mentioned this enormous potential in technological advances that can allow a positive peace. Can you share with us your vision of this enormous potential?
Yes. Now, thank you for that. You know, obviously, artificial intelligence has its pluses and its minuses. And in fact, it could dehumanize. It could, if it starts taking decisions, if the algorithms start imposing upon humanity rather than serving the needs of humanity and workers, then we're in difficulties.
Can I just push the button to turn it off?
Well, no, if it takes control of the button.
That's a problem.
You could just pull a plug, you could say. No, I actually do believe that the enormous inventiveness of humanity. Look at the pharmaceutical industry, in fact, where artificial intelligence has already discovered certain compounds which have absolute breakthrough. It takes millions and millions of iterations, but which can help human health, for people to live longer And it's not just a question of living longer life, it's a more healthy life,
healthier,
dignified life.
Exactly.
Look at the technology we're using. Isn't that magnificent? Mm. Of course, it's got to be controlled and constrained. And of course, it's always weaponized as well. But, you know, I actually do think that electric vehicles, solar power, all of that, instead of these old industrial revolution of belching black smoke into the sky.
Right.
You know, we want beautiful cities with trees, people to live and have fresh air, water and ponds and so on, and finding ways to fighting mosquitoes, viruses, all of that.
But they all take global governance, functioning global governance.
But we've already achieved so much, given the fact that people already live far longer and healthier lives. And until these wars, we were taking out more and more people globally out of poverty. Africa is on the move. Mm. It really is. Massive economic development, which, you know, is really going to become the great supercontinent of the next century. But as I say, it can only be done if we can establish this framework for positive peace. Then you'd say, Richard, why do you keep blaming the political West? Why do you keep blaming Washington? I do.
Mm-hmm.
I do. Mm-hmm. Because they have to show response. And Europeans, where are they? Where is their voice for peace? Where is their voice for development? Mm-hmm. It is gone. Why is it in Europe's interest to decouple from China? Mm-hmm. Washington has worked for 40 years to prevent a genuine deep relationship between Berlin and Moscow.
Mm.
And look, it has been brilliantly successful in fostering hate. It did everything possible to ensure that Russia and Ukraine did not establish genuine, deep economic and other interests. Brilliant success. Look, a war which has killed at least 500,000 people and threatens the collective fate of a nation of 150 Russia and the collective fate of 500 million in Western Europe.
And getting worse.
Brilliant success. They've succeeded. Washington is great. Europe is knocked out as a major power, a competitor. Russia is, you know, consumed by this war, and so it's out of the play for the next 10 years. What's not to like if you're sitting in Washington? And not as Lindsey Graham says, Senator, not a single American soldier has died officially. What's not to like?
But who is laughing?
Washington is laughing all the way to the bank.
But will they be laughing any longer?
Not when it starts hitting them.
Exactly, right?
Yeah,
I don't think anybody wins.
Of course. It's complete madness. Complete madness. And the fact that you're saying it, I'm saying it, is a sign of hope.
Yes. We're betting on that. And I hope more people will, you know, hear your voices.
They do.
And to end our interview, I want to quote two lines that I really like from your interviews. And that is, so nothing is inevitable, yet the dangers are unprecedentedly high.
Yes.
But of course, I'm focusing on the first part.
Yes.
Nothing is inevitable. Mm. And also that change begins with ourselves.
Yes.
And I want to share with you that I understand these lines deeply and I really appreciate them. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for saying that, because it means that these words and these thoughts and this work which has gone into it actually has resonance and
yes.
it has meaning. So I much appreciate that.
Resonates with the deepest part of our human beings. I believe not just with me, but people in America, but people in Europe.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Professor.
That was my conversation with Professor Richard Sakwa from the Department of Russian and European Politics at the University of Kent at Canterbury, UK. Thank you for listening.